we all fall down. 22. Madrid, Paris. The old complacency had returned to Madrid, but this was to be expected. It had been 7 years since the deadly train bombings, and memories of that terrible morning had long since faded. Spain had responded to the massacre of its citizens by withdrawing its troops from Iraq and launching what it described as an alliance of civilizations with the Islamic world. Such action, said the political commentators, had succeeded in redirecting Muslim rage from Spain to America, where it rightly belonged. Submission to the wishes of Al-Qaeda would protect Spain from another attack. Or so they thought. The bomb exploded at 9:12 p.m., at the intersection of two busy streets near Puerta del Sol. It had been assembled at a rented garage in an industrial quarter south of the city and concealed in a Peugeot van. Owing to its ingenious construction, the initial force of the blast was directed leftward, into a restaurant popular with Spanish governing elites. There would be no first-hand account of precisely what occurred inside, for no one lived to describe it. Had there been a survivor, he would have recounted a brief but terrible instant of airborne bodies adrift in a lethal cloud of gas, cutlery, ceramic, and blood. Then the entire building collapsed, entombing the dead and dying together beneath a mountain of shattered masonry. The damage was greater than even the terrorist had hoped. Facades were ripped from apartment buildings for an entire block, exposing lives that, until a few seconds earlier, had been proceeding peacefully. Several nearby shops and cafes suffered damage and casualties, while the small trees lining the street were shorn of their leaves or uprooted entirely. There were no visible remnants of the Peugeot van, only a large crater in the street where it once had been. For the first 24 hours of the investigation, the Spanish police were convinced the bomb had been detonated remotely. Later, they discovered traces of the Shahid's DNA sprayed amid the ruins. He was just 20. An unemployed Moroccan carpenter from the Lavapié district of Madrid. In his suicide video, he spoke fondly of Yaqub al-Mansur, the 12th century Almohad Caliph, known for his bloody raids into Christian lands. It was against this dreadful backdrop that Zoe Reed of the American business news network CNBC placed her first call to the publicity department of AAB Holdings, formerly of Riyadh and Geneva, lately of the Boulevard Haussmann, in the 9th arrondissement of Paris. The time was 4:10 in the afternoon, the weather in Paris predictably overcast. The inquiry received no immediate response per standing AAB protocol. Annually cited by Forbes magazine as one of the most successful and innovative investment firms in the world, the company was founded in 1979 by Abdulaziz Al-Bakari. Known to friends and detractors alike as Zizi, he was the 19th son of a prominent Saudi merchant who had served as the personal banker and financial advisor to Ibn Saud, the kingdom's founder and first absolute monarch. AAB's holdings were as extensive as they were lucrative. AAB did shipping and mining. AAB did chemicals and drugs. AAB had major stakes in American and European banks. AAB's real estate and hotel division was one of the world's largest. Zizi travelled the world on a gold-plated 747, owned a string of palaces stretching from Riyadh to the French Riviera to Aspen, and sailed the seas on a battleship-sized yacht called the Alexandra. His collection of Impressionist and modern art was thought to be among the largest in private hands. For a short period, it included Marguerite Gachet at her dressing table by Vincent van Gogh, purchased from Isherwood Fine Arts, 7-8 Mason's Yard, St. James's, London. The sale had been brokered by a young American named Sarah Bancroft, who went on to serve briefly as Zizi's primary art consultant. He was the target of many rumours, particularly regarding the source of his enormous fortune. AAB's glossy prospectus claimed it had been built entirely from the modest inheritance Zizi received from his father, a claim that an authoritative American business journal, after a careful investigation, found wanting. AAB's extraordinary liquidity, it said, could be explained by only one thing. It was being used as a front for the House of Saud to quietly reinvest its petrodollars around the world. Outraged by the article, Zizi threatened to sue. Later, on the advice of his lawyers, he had a change of heart. "The best revenge is living well," he told a reporter from the Wall Street Journal. and that is something I know how to do. Perhaps. But the handful of Westerners who were granted entree into Zizi's inner circle always sensed a certain restlessness in him. His parties were lavish affairs, yet Zizi seemed to take no pleasure in them. He neither smoked nor drank alcohol, and refused to be in the presence of dogs or pork. He prayed 5 times a day. Each winter, when the rains made the Saudi desert bloom, he retreated to an isolated encampment in the Nejd, to meditate and hunt with his falcons. He claimed to be a descendant of Muhammad Abdul Wahhab, the 18th-century preacher whose austere, puritanical version of Islam became the official creed of Saudi Arabia. He built mosques around the world, including several in America and Western Europe, and gave generously to the Palestinians. Firms looking to do business with AAB knew better than to send a Jew to meet with Zizi. According to the rumour mill, Zizi liked Jews even less than he liked losses on his investments. As it turned out, Zizi's charitable activities extended far beyond what was publicly known. He also gave generously to charities associated with Islamic extremism, and even directly to Al-Qaeda itself. Eventually he crossed the thin but bright line separating the financiers and enablers of terrorism from the terrorists themselves. The result was an attack on the Vatican that left more than 700 people dead and the dome of St. Peter's Basilica in ruins. With Sarah Bancroft's help, Gabriel hunted down the man who planned the attack, a renegade Saudi intelligence officer named Ahmed bin Shafiq, and killed him in a hotel room in Istanbul. A week later, on the Quai Saint-Pierre in Cannes, he killed Zizi too. Despite his adherence to Saudi traditions, Zizi had but 2 wives, both of whom he had divorced, and a single child, a beautiful daughter named Nadia. She buried her father in the Wahhabi tradition in an unmarked desert grave, and immediately consolidated her hold on his assets. She moved AAB's European headquarters from Geneva, which bored her, to Paris, where she was more comfortable. A few of the firm's more pious employees refused to work for a woman, especially one who shunned the veil and consumed alcohol. But most stayed on. Under Nadia's guiding hand, the company entered previously uncharted territories. She acquired a famous French fashion company, an Italian maker of luxury leather goods, a substantial portion of an American investment bank, and a German motion picture production company. She also made significant changes to her personal holdings. Her father's many homes and estates were quietly put up for sale, as was the Alexandra and his 747. Nadia now travelled on a more modest Boeing business jet and owned just 2 homes, a graceful mansion on the Avenue Foch in Paris and a lavish palace in Riyadh that she rarely saw. Despite her lack of formal business training, she had proved to be an adept and skillful manager. The total value of the assets now under AAB's control was higher than at any point in company history, and Nadia Al-Bakari, at just 33, was regarded as one of the richest women in the world. AAB's media relations, such as they were, fell under the purview of Nadia's executive assistant, a well-preserved French woman of 50 named Yvette Dubois. Madame Dubois rarely bothered to acknowledge requests from reporters, especially those employed by American companies, but upon receiving a follow-up call from the famous Zoe Reed, she decided a response was in order. She allowed another day to elapse, then, for good measure, she placed the call in the middle of the night, New York time, when she assumed Ms. Reed would be sleeping. For reasons not known to Madame Dubois, that turned out not to be the case. The conversation that followed was cordial but hardly promising. Madame Dubois explained that the offer of a 1-hour prime-time special, while flattering, was entirely beyond the realm of possibility. Ms. Al-Bakari was travelling constantly, and had several large deals pending. More to the point, Ms. Al-Bakari simply didn't do the kind of interview Ms. Reed had in mind.
"Will you at least give her the request?"
"I'll give it to her," the Frenchwoman said, "but the chances are not good."
"But not zero?" Zoe asked, probing.
"Let's not play little word games, Miss Reed. They're beneath us."
Madame Dubois' concluding remark produced an outburst of much-needed laughter at Chateau Treville, an 18th-century French manor house located north of Paris, just beyond the village of Serancourt. Shielded from prying eyes by 12-foot walls, It had a heated swimming pool, 2 clay tennis courts, 32 acres of manicured gardens, and 14 ornate bedrooms. Gabriel had rented it in the name of a German high-tech firm that existed only in the imagination of an office corporation lawyer, and promptly sent the bill along to Ari Shamron at King Saul Boulevard. Under normal circumstances, Shamron would have balked at the exorbitant price tag. Instead, with no small amount of pleasure, he forwarded the bill to Langley, which had assumed responsibility for all operational expenses. For the next several days, Gabriel and his team spent most of their time monitoring the feed from Zoe's BlackBerry, which was now functioning as a tireless little electronic spy in her pocket. They knew her precise latitude and longitude, and when she was in motion, they knew the speed at which she was travelling. They knew when she was buying her morning coffee at Starbucks, when she was stuck in New York traffic, and when she was annoyed with her producers, which was often. By monitoring her internet activity, they knew she was planning to remodel her Upper West Side apartment. By reading her email, they knew she had many romantic suitors, including a millionaire bond trader who, despite heavy losses, somehow found the time to drop her at least 2 missives a day. They sensed, in spite of all her success, that Zoe was not altogether happy in America. She whispered coded greetings to them often. At night, her sleep was made restless by nightmares. To the rest of the world, however, she projected an air of cool indomitability, and to the select few who were privileged to witness her seduction of the French publicist, she provided yet more proof that she was the greatest natural spy any of them had ever encountered. Her tradecraft was a textbook combination of sound technique matched with unyielding persistence. Zoe flattered, Zoe cajoled, and at the end of one particularly contentious phone call, Zoe even managed a few tears. Even so, Madame Dubois proved to be more than a worthy opponent. After a week she declared the negotiations at an impasse, only to reverse course 2 days later by unexpectedly sending Zoe a detailed questionnaire. Zoe completed the document in perfect French, and returned it the following morning, at which point Madame Dubois adopted a posture of radio silence. At Chateau Treville, Gabriel's team lapsed into an uncharacteristic despair, as several precious days slipped past with no further contact. Only Zoe was optimistic. She had been through many such seductions in the past, and knew when the hook had been set. "I've got her, darling," she murmured to Gabriel late one night, as the BlackBerry was recharging on her bedside table. "It's only a question of when she capitulates." Zoe's prediction proved correct, though the Frenchwoman would allow an additional 24 hours to elapse before announcing her conditional surrender. It came in the form of a grudging invitation. It seemed that, owing to an unexpected cancellation, Ms. Albakari was free for lunch in 2 days' time. Would Ms. Reed be willing to make the trip to Paris on such short notice? The consummate professional, Zoe waited 90 annoying minutes before returning the call and accepting. "Let me be clear about one thing," Madame Dubois said. "This is not an interview. The luncheon will be completely off the record. If Ms. Albakari feels comfortable in your presence, she will consider taking the next step."
"Where shall I meet her?"
"As you might expect, Ms. Albakari finds it difficult to conduct business in restaurants. We've taken the liberty of booking the Louis XV suite at the Hôtel de Crillon. She's expecting you at 1:30. Ms. Albakari insists on paying. It's one of her rules."
"Does she have any others I should know about?"
"Ms. Albakari is sensitive about questions concerning the death of her father," Madame Dubois said, "and I wouldn't dwell on the subject of Islam and terrorism. She finds it terribly boring. A tout à l'heure, Ms. Reed."
23. Paris. In the aftermath, the team would recall the period of preparation that came next as among the most unpleasant they had ever endured. The cause was none other than Gabriel, whose brittle mood cast a pall over the rooms of Chateau Treville. He quibbled over the placement of observation posts, second-guessed backup plans, and even briefly considered requesting a change of venue. Under normal circumstances, the team would not have hesitated to push back, but they could sense that something about the operation had set Gabriel on edge. Dina reckoned it was Covent Garden, and the terrible memories of the shot not taken, a theory that was dismissed by Ellie Lavon. It was not London that weighed on Gabriel's mind, Lavon explained, but Cannes. Gabriel had violated a personal canon that night. He had killed Zizi in front of his daughter.
Zizi al-Bakari, financier of mass murder, had deserved to die. But Nadia, his only child, had not been obliged to witness it. Only Zoe Reed remained shielded from Gabriel's bout of bad temper. She spent an unhurried final day in New York, then at 5:30 that afternoon boarded Air France Flight 17 bound for Paris. An experienced traveller, she carried only a small overnight bag and a briefcase containing her notebook computer and research packet, which included a file of highly classified material, along with a detailed briefing paper on strategy for the luncheon. The items were handed to Zoe shortly after takeoff by her seatmate, an operative from the office's New York station, and were collected again shortly before landing. Still in possession of a British passport, Zoe breezed through customs in the EU Express line and took a car service into the city centre. It was approaching 9 when she arrived at the Clio. After checking into her room, she changed into a tracksuit and went for a run along the footpaths of the Jardin des Tuileries. At 11:30, she presented herself at an exclusive salon next to the hotel for a wash and blow-dry, then returned to her room to dress for lunch. She departed her room early and was standing in the elegant lobby, hands clasped to conceal a bout of nerves, as the stately grandfather clock tolled 4:15. It was the quiet time of the year at the Creole, the annual ceasefire between the running battle of the summer season and the celebrity-strewn ambush of the winter holidays. Monsieur Didier, the chief concierge, stood behind his barricade, gold half-moon reading glasses perched at the end of his regal nose, looking like the last man on earth anyone would ask for assistance. Herr Schmidt, the imported German day manager, stood a few feet away at reception, holding a telephone to his ear, while Isabel, the special events coordinator, fussed with orchids in the sparkling entrance hall. Her efforts went largely unnoticed by the bored-looking Arab businessman sitting near the elevators, and by the pair of lovers huddled over their café crème in the cold shadows of the interior courtyard. The businessman was actually an employee of AAB's generously staffed security department. The lovers were Yakov and Chiara. The hotel staff believed them to be an agreeable couple from Montreal who had popped into Paris on short notice to comfort a friend going through a messy divorce. As the clock struck the bottom of the hour, Isabel drifted over to the doorway and peered expectantly into the leaden Paris afternoon. Zoe glanced into the courtyard and saw Yakov tapping a book of matches on the tabletop. It was the prearranged signal indicating that the motorcade, 2 S-Class Mercedes sedans for the hired help and a Maybach 62 for Her Highness, had departed AAB's building on the Boulevard Haussmann and was en route to the hotel. At that moment, the cars were actually stuck in traffic along the narrow Rue de Miromesnil. Once free of the obstruction, it took just 5 minutes for them to reach the entrance of the Crillon, where Isabel, flanked by the better-looking half of the bell staff, now stood. The undercover AAB security man was no longer feigning boredom. He was now hovering at Zoe's shoulder, making little effort to conceal the fact he was armed. Outside, 6 car doors opened in unison, and 6 men, all former members of the elite Saudi National Guard, emerged. One was familiar to Gabriel and the rest of the team. Rafiq al-Kamal, the burly former chief of Zizi al-Bakari's personal security detail, who now served in the same capacity for his daughter. It was al-Kamal who had conducted the advance sweep of the hotel earlier that morning, and it was al-Kamal who now walked a subservient step behind Nadia as she flowed from the back of her Maybach into the lobby, where Zoe stood with a porcelain smile fixed upon her face, and her heart beating against her breastbone. There exist in the file rooms of King Saul Boulevard many photos of a younger version of Nadia, or as Elie Lavon was fond of saying, Nadia before the fall. Zoe had been given access to some of the more illustrative shots during the flight from New York. They showed a petulant woman in her mid-20s, darkly beautiful, spoiled, and superior. She was a woman who smoked cigarettes and drank alcohol behind her father's back, and who, in violation of Muhammad's teachings, bared her flesh on some of the world's most glamorous beaches. Her father's death had straightened Nadia's carriage and lent a serious light to her face, yet it had robbed her of none of her beauty. She wore a radiant dress of winter white, with her dark hair hanging straight between her shoulder blades like a satin cape. Her nose was long and straight. Her eyes were wide and nearly black. Pearls lay against the caramel-coloured skin of her neck. A thick gold bracelet sparkled on her slender wrist. Her scent was an intoxicating blend of jasmine, lavender, and the sun. Her hand, when it closed around Zoe's, was as cool as marble.
"It's such a pleasure to finally meet you," Nadia said, in an accent that betrayed no origin other than unfathomable wealth. "I've heard so much about your work."
She smiled for the first time, a cautious effort that did not quite extend to her eyes. Zoe felt slightly claustrophobic in the enclosure of the bodyguards, but Nadia conducted herself as though she were unaware of their presence.
"I'm sorry to make you come all the way to Paris on such short notice."
"Not at all, Ms. Al-Bakari."
"Nadia," she said, her smile genuine now. "I insist you call me Nadia."
Al-Kamal appeared anxious to move the party out of the lobby, as did Madame Dubois, who was rocking slightly from heel to toe. Zoe suddenly felt an unseen hand on her elbow nudging her toward the elevators. She squeezed into a cramped carriage next to Nadia and her bodyguards and had to turn her shoulders slightly in order for the door to close. The scent of jasmine and lavender in the confined space was mildly hallucinogenic. On Nadia's breath was the faintest trace of the last cigarette she had smoked.
"Do you come to Paris often, Zoe?"
"Not as often as I used to," she answered.
"You've stayed at the Crillon before?"
"Actually, it's my first time."
"You really must allow me to pay for your room."
"I'm afraid that's not possible," Zoe said with a gracious smile.
"It's the least I can do."
"It would also be unethical."
"How so?"
"It could create the appearance that I'm accepting something of value in return for a favorable news piece. My company forbids it. Most journalistic enterprises do, at least the reputable ones."
"I didn't realize there was such a thing."
"A reputable journalistic enterprise?" Zoe offered a confiding smile.
"One or two." "Including yours?"
"Including mine," said Zoe. "In fact, I would feel much more comfortable if you would allow me to pay for lunch."
"Don't be silly."
"Besides," Nadia added, "I'm sure the famous Zoe Reed would never allow herself to be influenced by a nice lunch in a Paris hotel." They passed the rest of the journey in silence. When the doors of the elevator finally rattled open, Al-Kamal surveyed the vestibule before leading Zoe and Nadia briskly into the Louis XV suite. The classical French furnishings in the sitting room had been rearranged to create the impression of an elegant private dining room. Before the tall windows overlooking the Place de la Concorde was a round table set for two. Nadia surveyed the room with approval before snuffing out the single candle burning amid the crystal and silver. Then, with a movement of her dark eyes, she invited Zoe to sit. There ensued a somewhat farcical few moments of unfurling napkins, closing doors, furtive glances, and murmured exchanges, some in French, some in Arabic. Finally, at Nadia's insistence, the security men retreated into the corridor, accompanied by Madame Dubois, who was visibly uneasy about the prospect of leaving her boss alone with a famous reporter. The sommelier poured a few drops of Montrachet into Nadia's glass. Nadia pronounced it satisfactory, then looked at Zoe's blackberry, which was resting on the table like an uninvited guest.
"Would you mind turning that off?" she asked, attempting to make light of the request. "One can never be too careful these days when it comes to electronic devices. You never know who might be listening."
"I understand completely," said Zoe. Nadia returned her glass to the table and said,
"I'm sure you do."
Were it not for the miniature transmitter carefully concealed in the hotel suite, those four words, at once innocent and ominous, might have been the last heard by the man of medium height and build pacing the rooms of a chateau north of Paris. Instead, with a few keystrokes on his notebook computer, the audio feed resumed with only a brief interruption. In the courtyard of the Crillon, the couple from Montreal departed, replaced by two women in their mid-30s. One had sandstone-coloured hair and child-bearing hips, the other had dark hair and walked with a slight limp. She pretended to read a glossy Paris fashion magazine. It helped to quiet the clock, ticking relentlessly in her head. 24. Paris. Some recruitments are like seductions. Some border on extortion, and still others are like a ballet of the wounded. But even Ari Shamron, who had haunted the secret world far longer than most, would later say that he had never witnessed anything quite like the recruitment of Nadia Al-Bakari. Having listened to the opening act over a secure link at King Saul Boulevard, he declared it one of the most masterful pieces of field work he had ever heard. It was especially high praise given that the person doing the recruiting hailed from a profession for which Shamron had nothing but contempt. Gabriel had instructed his recruiter to go slowly, and go slowly she did. For the first hour of the encounter, as hushed waiters entered and departed the hotel suite, Zoe questioned Nadia respectfully on the many changes she had made to AAB's investment profile and on the challenges posed by the global recession without end. Much to Gabriel's surprise, the reclusive Saudi heiress turned out to be an engaging and forthright conversationalist who seemed far wiser than her 33 years. Indeed, there was not a trace of tension until Zoe nonchalantly asked Nadia how often she travelled to Saudi Arabia. The question produced the first uncomfortable silence of the encounter, just as Gabriel had expected it would. Nadia regarded Zoe for a moment with her bottomless dark eyes before responding with a question of her own.
"You've been to Saudi Arabia?"
"Once," replied Zoe.
"For your work?
Is there any other reason for a Westerner to go to Saudi Arabia?"
"I suppose not."
Nadia's expression softened.
"Where did you go?"
"I spent 2 days in Riyadh. Then I went to the Empty Quarter to tour the new Saudi Aramco oil drilling project at Sheba. It was very impressive."
"Actually, you described it as a technological marvel that will ensure Saudi domination of the global oil market for at least another generation."
Nadia gave a fleeting smile.
"Do you really think I would agree to a meeting without first reviewing your work? After all, you do have something of a reputation."
"For what?"
"Ruthlessness," said Nadia without hesitation. "They say you have something of a puritanical streak. They say you like to destroy companies and executives who step out of line."
"I don't do that kind of work any longer. I'm on television now. We don't investigate, we just talk."
"You don't miss being a real journalist?"
"By that you mean a print journalist?"
"Yes."
"Occasionally," Zoe admitted. "But then I look at my bank account and I feel much better."
"Is that why you left London? For money?"
"There were other reasons."
"What kind of reasons?"
"The kind I generally don't discuss in professional settings."
"It sounds as though it had something to do with a man," Nadia said, her tone conciliatory.
"You're very perceptive."
"Yes, I am."
Nadia reached for her wine glass, but stopped.
"I don't go to Saudi Arabia often," she said suddenly. "Once every 3 or 4 months, no more. And when I do go, I don't stay for long."
"Because?"
"For the reasons you would expect."
Nadia appeared to choose her next words with great care.
"The laws and customs of Islam and Saudi Arabia are old and very important to our society. I've learned how to navigate the system in a way that allows me to conduct my business with a minimum of disruption."
"What about your countrywomen?"
"What about them?"
"Most aren't as lucky as you are. Women in Saudi Arabia are considered property, not people. Most spend their lives locked away indoors. They're not permitted to drive an automobile. They're not permitted to go out in public without a male escort and without first concealing themselves beneath an abaya and a veil. They're not permitted to travel, even inside the country, without receiving permission from their fathers or older brothers. Honour killings are permissible if a woman brings shame upon her family or engages in un-Islamic behaviour. And adultery is a crime punishable by stoning. In the birthplace of Islam, women cannot even enter a mosque except in Mecca and Medina, which is odd, since the Prophet Muhammad was something of a feminist. 'Treat your women well and be kind to them,' the Prophet said, 'for they are your partners and committed helpers.'" Nadia picked at an invisible flaw in the tablecloth.
"I admire your honesty, Zoe. Most journalists trying to secure an important interview would resort to platitudes and flattery."
"I can do that, if you prefer."
"Actually, I prefer honesty. We don't have enough of that in Saudi Arabia. In fact, we avoid it at all costs."
Nadia turned her gaze toward the windows. Outside it was dark enough so that her image was reflected ghost-like in the glass.
"I never realized you were so interested in the condition of Muslim women," she said softly. "There's no evidence of it in your previous work."
"How much of it did you read?"
"All of it,"
said Nadia. There were many stories about corrupt businessmen, but not one about the plight of Muslim women. I'm interested in the rights of all women, regardless of their faith.
Zoe paused, then added provocatively,
I would think that someone in your position would be interested in them as well.
Why would you think such a thing?
Because you have the power and influence to be an important role model.
I run a large company, Zoe. I don't have the time or desire to involve myself in politics.
You don't have any?
Any what?
Politics.
I am a citizen of Saudi Arabia, Nadia said. We have a king, not politics. Besides, in the Middle East, politics can be very dangerous.
Was your father killed because of politics?
Zoe asked cautiously. Nadia turned and gazed at Zoe.
I don't know why my father was killed. I'm not sure anyone does, other than his murderers, of course.
A heavy silence fell between them. It was broken a few seconds later by the sound of a door opening. A pair of waiters entered bearing trays of coffee and pastries. They were followed by Rafiq al-Kamal, the chief of security, and Madame Dubois, who was tapping the face of her Cartier wristwatch as if to say the meeting had gone on long enough. Zoe feared Nadia might latch on to the signal as an excuse to take her leave. Instead, she ordered the intruders from the room with an imperious wave of her hand. She did the same for the waiter holding the tray of pastries, but accepted the coffee. She drank it black, with an extraordinary amount of sugar.
Are these the kinds of questions you propose to ask me on camera? Questions about the rights of women in Saudi Arabia? Questions about the death of my father? We don't divulge the questions in advance of an interview.
Come, come, Zoe. We both know how this works. Zoe made a brief show of thought.
If I failed to ask you about your father, I would be brought up on charges of journalistic malpractice. It makes you a deeply compelling figure.
What it makes me is a woman without a father. Nadia removed a packet of Virginia Slims from her handbag and ignited one with a rather ordinary-looking gold lighter.
You were there that night in Cannes?
I was, said Nadia.
One minute we were all enjoying a wonderful evening in our favourite restaurant. The next I was holding my father, as he lay dying in the street. You saw the men who killed him?
There were two, she said, nodding her head.
They rode motorcycles, very fast, very skillfully. At first I thought they were just French boys having a bit of fun on a warm summer night. Then I saw the weapons. They were obviously professionals.
She drew on her cigarette and exhaled a slender stream of smoke toward the ceiling.
After that, everything is a blur. There were reports that witnesses heard you screaming for revenge.
I'm afraid that retribution is the Bedouin way, Nadia said sadly.
I suppose it runs in my blood. You admired your father?
Zoe pressed.
I did, Nadia said. He was an art collector, a voracious one. I understand you share your father's passion.
My art collection is private, Nadia said, reaching for her coffee.
Not as private as you think.
Nadia looked up sharply, but said nothing.
My sources tell me that you made an important acquisition last month. They tell me that you were the one who paid the record price for the Rothko at Christie's in New York.
Your sources are mistaken, Zoe.
My sources are never mistaken. And they've told me other things about you as well. Apparently you're not as indifferent to the rights of women in the Islamic world as you pretend to be. You've quietly given millions of dollars to combat violence against women, and millions more to promote female entrepreneurship, which you believe will have the effect of empowering Muslim women as never before. But your charitable works don't stop there. I'm told you've used your fortune to promote free and independent media in the Arab world. You've also attempted to counter the spread of dangerous Wahhabi ideology by donating to organizations that promote a more tolerant version of Islam.
Zoe paused.
Taken together, your activities paint a portrait of a courageous woman who is single-handedly trying to change the face of the modern Middle East.
Nadia managed a dismissive smile.
It's an intriguing story, she said after a moment. It's a shame none of it is true.
That's too bad, Zoe replied,
because there are people who would like to help you. What sort of people? People of discretion.
In the Middle East, people of discretion are either spies or terrorists.
I can assure you they're not terrorists.
So they must be spies, then.
I wasn't told their affiliation.
Nadia gave her a skeptical look. Zoe held out a card. It had no name, only the number of her BlackBerry.
This is my private number. It is important that you proceed with caution. As you know, there are people around you who do not share your goal of changing the Islamic world for the better, including your own bodyguards.
What is your interest in this matter, Zoe?
I have no interest, other than obtaining an interview with a woman I greatly admire.
Nadia hesitated. Then she accepted the card and slipped it into her handbag. At that instant, the door of the hotel suite opened again, and Madame Dubois entered with Rafiq al-Kamal at her side. She was once again tapping her wristwatch. This time Nadia rose. Looking suddenly fatigued, she extended her hand toward Zoe.
"I'm not sure I'm ready to lift the veil just yet," she said, "but I'd like some time to consider your offer. Would it be possible for you to remain in Paris for a few days?"
"It will be a terrible hardship," Zoe said jokingly, "but I'll try to manage."
Nadia released Zoe's hand and followed her security chief into the corridor. Zoe remained behind for a moment longer before returning to her room three floors below. There she powered on her BlackBerry and called her producer in New York to explain that she would be staying on in Paris to continue the negotiations. Then she placed the BlackBerry on her bedside table and sat for a long time at the end of her bed. She smelled jasmine and lavender, the scent of Nadia, and recalled the instant of their parting. Nadia's hand had been oddly cold to the touch. It was the hand of fear, thought Zoe. The hand of death.
25. Sarancourt, France.
Zoe's call to New York sounded in the high-ceilinged rooms of Chateau Treville like a fanfare of trumpets. Gabriel responded by immediately dispatching a secure cable to Adrian Carter, whereupon AAB Holdings and its owner, Nadia Al-Bakari, became the target of NSA surveillance. It meant that Carter now knew the name of the wealthy Muslim with unimpeachable jihadist credentials whom Gabriel wanted to fund Rashid's network. It also meant that at any given moment, several dozen other members of the sprawling American intelligence community knew it too. It was a risk Gabriel had no choice but to take. Israel's Signals Intelligence Service was formidable, but its capabilities paled in comparison to those of the NSA. America's mastery of the digital world was unrivaled. It was the human factor, the ability to recruit spies and to penetrate the courts of their enemies that eluded the Americans, and for that they had turned to the office. At Gabriel's request, Carter went to great lengths to conceal Nadia's name from the rest of official Washington. Despite the obvious potential implications for American-Saudi relations, he neglected to mention it to either the President or James McKenna at the weekly White House counter-terrorism meeting. He also took care to safeguard the identity of the party who would be reviewing the NSA intercepts. They were sent first to Carter's personal attention at Langley, and then routed to the CIA station in Paris. The deputy chief, a man who owed his career to Carter, drove them personally to the Grand Manor House at Sarancourt, where they were signed over to Sarah Bancroft. Of particular interest to Gabriel and the team was the telephone and email account of Rafiq al-Kamal, Nadia's chief of security. Despite numerous calls placed to contacts inside the Saudi GID and Interior Ministry, al-Kamal never once mentioned the name Zoe Reed. That was not true, however, of Madame Dubois, who spent much of the next 72 hours burning up the lines between Paris and London, searching for dirt and gossip in Zoe's professional past. Gabriel took this as an encouraging sign. It meant that, as far as AAB was concerned, the investigative reporter from CNBC was a public relations problem, not a security threat. Zoe remained blissfully unaware of the intrigue swirling around her. Following Gabriel's carefully prepared script, she refrained from further contact with AAB or its employees. To help fill the empty hours, she visited museums and took long walks along the Seine, which allowed Ellie Levon and the rest of the field operatives to determine that she was free of any surveillance. As two more days slipped past with no word from Nadia, Zoe's producer in New York began to grow impatient.
"I want you back in the States on Monday at the latest," he told her by telephone, with or without the exclusive. It's simply a question of money. Nadia has barrels full of it. We're pinching every penny.
The call darkened the mood of the Salancourt safe house, as did the speech given by the French president that afternoon to an emergency session of the National Assembly.
It is not a question of whether France will be attacked by terrorists again, the president warned, but only a question of when and where. It is a sad fact that more lives will be lost to the fires of extremism. Regrettably, this is what it means to be a citizen of Europe in the 21st century.
A few minutes after the speech ended, a message arrived from the operations desk at Kingsall Boulevard. It was just 4 characters in length, 2 letters followed by 2 numbers. But its meaning was unambiguous. God was cooling his heels in a Montmartre safe flat, and God wanted a word with Gabriel in private. 26. Montmartre, Paris. The apartment house stood on the Rue Lepic, not far from the cemetery. It was grey in colour and 7 floors in height, with wrought iron balustrades and garret rooms across the top. A single leafless tree rose from the centre courtyard, and from the neat foyer spiralled a staircase with a well-worn runner that muffled Gabriel's footfalls as he ascended swiftly to the 3rd floor. The door to apartment 3A hung slightly ajar. In the sitting room was an elderly man dressed in pressed khaki trousers, a white Oxford cloth shirt, and a leather bomber jacket with an unrepaired tear in the left shoulder. He had settled himself at the edge of a brocade-covered wing chair with his legs slightly splayed and his large hands bunched atop the crook of his olive-wood cane, like a traveller on a rail platform resigned to a long wait. Between 2 yellowed fingers burned the stub of a filterless cigarette. Acrid smoke swirled above his head like a private storm cloud.
"You're looking well," said Ari Shamron. "Being back in the field obviously agrees with you."
"It's not exactly how I'd planned to spend the winter."
"Then perhaps you shouldn't have followed a suicide bomber into Covent Garden."
Shamron gave a mirthless smile, then crushed out his cigarette in the ashtray on the coffee table. 6 other stubs were already there, lined in a neat row, like bullets waiting to be loaded into a gun. He added the 7th and peered thoughtfully at Gabriel through the fog of smoke.
"It's good to see you, my son. I thought our meeting in Cornwall last summer was going to be our last."
"Actually, I was hoping it would be."
"Can you at least pretend to have some regard for my feelings?"
"No."
Shamron ignited another cigarette with his old Zippo lighter and purposely blew smoke in Gabriel's direction.
"How eloquent," said Gabriel.
"Words sometimes fail me. Fortunately, my enemies rarely do, and once again they've managed to deliver you back into the arms of Kingsall Boulevard, where you belong."
"Temporarily."
"Ah, yes,"
Shamron agreed with disingenuous haste.
"By all means. This arrangement is purely temporary."
Gabriel went to the French doors overlooking the Rue Lepic and opened one. A chill draught entered the room, bringing with it the sound of the evening traffic.
"Must you?"
Shamron asked, frowning.
"My doctor says I should avoid drafts."
"Mine says I should avoid second-hand smoke. Thanks to you, I have the lungs of a man who smokes 40 cigarettes a day."
"At some point, you're going to have to stop blaming me for everything that's gone wrong in your life."
"Why?"
"Because it's counterproductive."
"It also happens to be the truth."
"I've always found it best to avoid the truth. It invariably leads to unnecessary complications."
Gabriel closed the door, muting the sound of the traffic, and asked Shamron why he had come to Paris.
"Uzi thought you could use some extra help on the ground."
"Why didn't he tell me you were coming?"
"It must have slipped his mind."
"Does he even know you're here?"
"No."
Gabriel couldn't help but smile.
"Let's try this one more time, Ari. Why are you in Paris?"
"I was worried."
"About the operation?"
"About you," Shamron said. "That's what it means to be a father. We worry about our children until the day we die."
"I'm afraid I wouldn't know anything about that."
"Forgive me, my son,"
Chamron said after a moment.
I should have known better. After all, that's my fault, too.
He pushed himself upright, and, leaning heavily on his cane, moved into the kitchen. The components of a coffee press lay scattered across the countertop, along with an empty tea kettle and an open bag of Carte Noire. Chamron made a feeble attempt to light the gas stove before raising his hands in a gesture of surrender. Gabriel nudged him toward the small cafe-style table and lifted the bag of coffee cautiously to his nose. It smelled like dust.
"Unless I'm mistaken,"
Chamron said, lowering himself into the chair,
"it's the same coffee we drank the last time we were here."
"There's a market next door. Do you think you can survive alone until I get back?"
With a dismissive wave of his hand, Chamron indicated the coffee was good enough. Gabriel filled the tea kettle with water and placed it on the stove to boil.
"There's still one thing I don't understand,"
Chamron said, watching him carefully.
"It's really not that complicated, Ari. First you pour in the coffee, then you add the water, then you push the little plunger."
"I was referring to Covent Garden. Why did you follow him? Why didn't you simply warn Graham Seymour and go back to your cottage by the sea?"
Gabriel made no response.
"Will you allow me to offer a possible explanation?"
"If you insist."
"You went after him, because you knew full well the British had neither the courage nor the resolve to stop him on their own. Our European friends are in the midst of a full-blown existential crisis. I'm convinced it's one of the reasons they despise us. We have a purpose. We believe our cause is just. They believe in nothing except their 35-hour work week, their global warming, and their annual 6-week vacation in the South. What boggles the mind is why you choose to live among them.
Because once upon a time they actually believed in God, and their faith inspired them to paint like angels."
"That's true," Chamron said. "But faith in God now resides almost exclusively in the jihadis. Unfortunately, it's a faith that was born of Wahhabi intolerance and fed by Saudi money. After 9/11, the Saudis promised to put an end to the incitement that gave rise to Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. But now, just 10 years later, Saudi money is once again fueling the hatred, with scarcely a word of protest from the Americans.
They've managed to convince themselves that the Saudis are an important ally in the fight against terrorism."
"They're delusional,"
Chamron said.
"But it's not entirely their fault. Oil isn't the only thing flowing from Saudi Arabia to the West. There's also a great deal of intelligence in the pipeline. The Saudi GID is constantly tipping off the CIA and the European services about potential plots and suspicious individuals. Occasionally the tips contain actionable intelligence, but most of it is complete and utter crap."
"You're not actually suggesting," Gabriel said sardonically, "that Saudi intelligence is playing the same old double game of combating the jihadists while at the same time supporting them?"
"That's exactly what I'm suggesting. And the Americans are so economically weak at the moment they're in no position to do anything about it."
The tea kettle began to hiss, and Gabriel filled the press with boiling water and stood over it while waiting for the coffee to steep. He glanced at Chamron. The dour expression on his face made it abundantly clear he was still thinking about the Americans.
"Every American administration has its buzzwords. This one likes to speak in terms of equity. They're constantly reminding us of the equity they have invested across the Middle East. They have equity in Iraq, equity in Afghanistan, and equity in maintaining a stable price of oil. At the moment, we don't count for much on the American balance sheet. But if you succeed in neutralizing Rashid's network,
it might add a bit of much-needed equity to our account."
Chamron nodded grimly.
"That doesn't mean, however, that we have to conduct ourselves like a wholly owned subsidiary of the CIA. In fact, the Prime Minister is adamant that we use this opportunity to take care of some unfinished business."
Like Malik al-Zubair?
Shamron nodded.
Something tells me you knew Malik was involved in this from the beginning.
Let's just say I had a strong suspicion that might be the case.
So when Adrian Carter invited me to come to Washington, I set aside my usual misgivings and agreed without hesitation.
How generous of you, said Gabriel. So why are you worried now?
Nadia.
She was your idea.
Maybe I was wrong. Maybe she's been fooling us all these years. Maybe she's more like her father than we think.
He paused, then added,
Maybe we should cut her loose and find someone else.
That person doesn't exist.
So forge him, Shamron said. I hear you're quite good at that.
It's not possible, and you know it.
Gabriel carried the coffee to the table and poured out two cups. Shamron dumped sugar into his and stirred it thoughtfully for a moment.
Even if Nadia al-Bakari agrees to work for you, Shamron said, you will have no means of keeping her under discipline. We have our traditional methods. Kesef, kavod, kusit, money, respect, sex. Nadia al-Bakari has no need for any of those things. Therefore, she cannot be controlled.
Then I suppose we'll just have to trust each other.
Trust? Shamron asked. I'm sorry, Gabriel, but I'm not familiar with that word.
He drank some of his coffee and grimaced.
There's an old proverb that I'm particularly fond of. It says, the veil that hides the future from us is woven by an angel of mercy. Unfortunately, there's no veil that can shield us from our past. It's filled with ghosts. The ghosts of loved ones, the ghosts of enemies. They're with us always. They're here with us now.
His roomy blue eyes searched the tiny kitchen for a moment before settling again on Gabriel.
Perhaps it's better to leave the past undisturbed. Better for Nadia. Better for you.
Gabriel examined Shamron carefully.
Am I mistaken, Ari? Are you actually feeling guilty about pulling me back in?
You made your wishes clear last summer in Cornwall. I should have respected them.
You never did before. Why start now?
Because you've earned it. And the last thing you need at this stage of your life is a confrontation with the child of a man you killed in cold blood.
I don't plan to confess my sins.
You might not have a choice in the matter. Shamron said. But promise me one thing, Gabriel. If you insist on using her, be certain you don't make the same mistake the Americans made with Rashid. Assume she is a mortal enemy and treat her accordingly.
Why don't you join us? We have plenty of room at the safe house for one more.
I'm an old man, Shamron said gloomily. I'd just be in the way.
So what are you going to do?
I'm going to sit here, alone, and worry. These days that seems to be my lot in life.
Don't start worrying just yet, Ari. It's possible Nadia won't come.
She'll come, Shamron said.
How can you be so sure?
Because in her heart she knows that you are the one whispering in her ear. And she won't be able to resist the opportunity to have a look at your face.
Operational doctrine dictated that Gabriel return immediately to Chateau Treville, but anger obliged him to make a pilgrimage to the Champs-Élysées. He arrived shortly after midnight to find that all evidence of the bombing had been carefully erased. The shops and restaurants had been repaired, the buildings had been given new windows and a fresh coat of paint, the paving stones had been washed of the blood. There was no expression of outrage, no memorial to the dead, no plea for sanity in a world gone mad. Indeed, were it not for the pair of gendarmes standing watch over the street corner, it might have been possible to imagine that nothing disagreeable had ever occurred there. For a moment, Gabriel regretted his decision to come, but as he was leaving, a secure email from the team at Serancourt unexpectedly lifted his spirits. It said that Nadia al-Bakari, the daughter of a man whom Gabriel had killed in the old port of Cannes, had just been overheard cancelling a trip to St. Petersburg,
Gabriel returned the blackberry to his coat pocket and walked on through the lamplight. The veil that hid his future had been torn in two. He saw a beautiful woman with raven hair crossing the forecourt of a chateau north of Paris, and an old man sitting alone in a Montmartre apartment, worrying himself to death. 27. Paris. Nadia Albakari personally telephoned Zoe Reed at 10:22 a.m. the next morning to invite her to tea at her mansion on the Avenue Foch. Zoe politely declined. It seemed she already had plans. "I'm spending the afternoon with an old friend from London. He made a pile of money in private equity and bought himself a chateau in the Val d'Oise. I'm afraid he's throwing a small party in my honour."
"A birthday party?"
"How did you know?"
"My security staff conducted a discreet background check before our lunch at the Crillon. As of today, you are 30.
"Please don't say it aloud. I'm trying to pretend it's just a bad dream." Nadia managed to laugh. Then she asked the name of Zoe's friend from London.
"Fowler. Thomas Fowler."
"What firm is he with?"
"Thomas doesn't do firms. Thomas is militantly independent. Apparently you met him a few years ago in the Caribbean. One of the French islands. Can't remember which. St. Bart's, I think it was. Or maybe it was Antigua."
"I've never set foot on Antigua."
"So it must have been St. Bart's."
There was silence.
"Did I lose you?" asked Zoe.
"No.
I'm still here. Is something wrong?"
"Where did I meet him?"
"He said it was in a bar near one of the beaches."
"Which bar?"
"Not sure about that."
"Which beach?"
"Don't think Thomas mentioned it."
"Was Thomas alone that day?"
"Actually, he was with his wife. Lovely girl. Bit on the pushy side, but I suppose that comes with the territory."
"Which territory is that?"
"Being the wife of a billionaire like Thomas."
More silence. Longer than the first.
"I'm afraid I don't remember him."
"He certainly remembers you."
"Describe him, please."
"Tallish chap. Built like a lamppost. A bit more interesting, once you get to know him. I think he did a deal a few years ago with an associate of your father."
"Do you happen to recall this associate's name?"
"Why don't you ask Thomas for yourself?"
"What are you saying, Zoe?"
On the second floor of Chateau Treville was a sombre music room with walls covered in red silk and lavish window treatments to match. At one end of the room was a harpsichord with gilded mouldings and a pastoral oil painting on the lid. At the other was an antique French Renaissance table with walnut inlay where Gabriel and Ellie Lavon sat staring into a pair of computers. On one was a blinking light showing Zoe Reed's current location and altitude. On the other was a recording of the conversation she had conducted at 10:22 with Nadia Albakari. 10 times Gabriel and Lavon had listened to it. 10 times they could find no excuse not to proceed. It was now 11:55. Lavon frowned as Gabriel clicked the play icon one final time.
"Do you happen to recall this associate's name? Why don't you ask Thomas for yourself?"
"What are you saying, Zoe?"
"I'm saying you should come to the party. I know Thomas would simply adore it, and it would give us a chance to spend some more time together."
"I'm afraid it wouldn't be appropriate."
"Why ever not?
Because your friend—"
"Forgive me, Zoe, but please tell me his name again."
"Thomas Fowler. Like the character in the Graham Greene novel."
"Who?"
"It's not important. What's important is that you come."
"I wouldn't want to be an imposition."
"You wouldn't be, for heaven's sake. Besides, it's my birthday, and I insist."
"Where exactly is your friend's home located?"
"Just north of Paris. The hotel's arranged a car for me."
"Tell the hotel to cancel it. We'll take my car instead. It will give us a chance to talk."
"Wonderful. Thomas says the dress code is chateau casual. But let's go light on the security, shall we? Thomas is a bit of a fanny patter, but he's otherwise quite harmless."
"I'll see you at noon, Zoe."
The call went dead.
Gabriel clicked on the stop icon and then looked up to find Yossi leaning in the doorway, looking every inch the prosperous private equity mogul who was spending the weekend at his French country retreat.
"For the record," he said in his lazy Oxford drawl, "I didn't appreciate the bit about a lamp post."
"I'm sure she meant it as a term of endearment.
How would you feel if someone compared you to a lamp post?"
"Endeared."
Yossi smoothed the front of his Bond Street cashmere jacket.
"Have we achieved chateau casual?"
"I believe we have."
"Ascot or no ascot?"
"No ascot."
"Ascot," said Levon. "Definitely ascot."
Yossi went out. Gabriel reached for the computer mouse again, but Levon stilled his hand.
"She knows it's us, and she's still coming. Besides," Levon added, "it's too late to do anything about it now."
Gabriel looked at the other computer screen. The elevation reading on the icon indicated that Zoe was sinking slowly toward the lobby. This was confirmed a few seconds later when Gabriel heard the sound of the elevator doors opening, followed by the clatter of Zoe's heels as she headed across the lobby. She bade good day to Herr Schmidt, thanked Isabel for the complimentary fruit basket that had been left in her room the previous evening, and blew a kiss to Monsieur Didier, who was at that moment attempting to secure a reservation at the Jules Verne for Chiara and Yakov, a reservation which, regrettably, they would later be forced to cancel. Next came a burst of traffic noise as Zoe stepped outside, followed in turn by the heavy thud of a limousine door closing. The ensuing silence was coffin-like. It was broken by the pleasant voice of a woman with unimpeachable jihadist credentials.
"It's so lovely to see you again, Zoe," said Nadia al-Bakari. "I brought your friend a bottle of Latour as a chateau-warming gift. I hope he likes red." "You shouldn't have. Don't be silly."
And with that, the icon was once again in motion, pursued by three other flashing beacons representing the surveillance teams. A moment later, they were all headed westward along the Champs-Élysées at a speed of 33 miles per hour. As they neared the Arc de Triomphe, Zoe offered to switch off her BlackBerry.
"Don't bother," said Nadia quietly. "I trust you now, Zoe. No matter what happens, I will always consider you a friend."
28. Sarancourt, France. The banlieues of northeastern Paris seemed to stretch for an eternity, but gradually the vulgar apartment blocks fell away and the first patches of green appeared. Even in winter, with the sky low and heavy, the French countryside looked as though it had been groomed for a family portrait. They roared through it in the black Maybach sedan, with no escort vehicles, at least none that Zoe could see. Rafiq al-Kamal, the pumice-faced security chief, sat scowling in the front passenger seat. He wore his usual dark suit, but, in deference to the informality of the occasion, no necktie. Nadia wore a rich, cream-coloured cashmere sweater, trim-fitting tan suede trousers, and low-heeled boots, suitable for walking along wooded country lanes. To hide her nerves, she spoke without pause. About the French. About the appalling fashions that winter. About an article she had read in the Financial Journal that very morning regarding the deplorable financial straits of the Eurozone economies. The heat inside the car was tropical. Zoe was perspiring beneath her clothing, but Nadia appeared slightly chilled. Her hands were curiously bloodless. Noticing Zoe's interest, she blamed it on the damp Parisian weather, of which she spoke without interruption until a road sign warned that they were approaching the village of Sarancourt. At that instant, a motorcycle overtook them. It was a high-powered Japanese model of the sort that compelled the driver to lean forward at an uncomfortable-looking angle. He looked into Zoe's window as he passed, as though curious about the occupants of so fine an automobile, then made an obscene gesture at the driver before vanishing behind a cloud of road spray.
"Hello, Mikhail," thought Zoe. "So nice to see you again."
She drew the BlackBerry from her handbag and dialed. The voice that answered was vaguely familiar. Of course it was, she reminded herself quickly. It belonged to her old friend, Thomas Fowler, from London. Thomas, who made a bundle investing in God only knew what. Thomas, who met Nadia a few years ago at a seaside bar in St. Bart's. Thomas, who was now giving Zoe directions to his showy new chateau. Right on the Rue de Vexin,
left on the Rue de Valais, right on the Route des Aides. The gate was on the left side of the road, he said, just beyond the old vineyard. Never mind the warning sign about the dogs, it was just a bluff for security's sake. Thomas was concerned about security. Thomas had good reason to be. Zoe severed the connection and returned the blackberry to her handbag. Looking up again, she caught Rafik al-Kamal eyeing her warily in his mirror. Nadia was gazing gloomily out her window at the passing countryside.
Smile, thought Zoe. We're going to a party, after all. It's important you try to smile.
There was no formal precedent for what they were attempting to do. No established doctrine. No office tradition upon which to draw. During the endless rehearsal sessions, Gabriel likened it to an unveiling, with Nadia as the potential buyer and Gabriel himself as the painting propped upon a display pedestal. The event would be preceded by a brief journey, a journey, he explained, that would take Nadia and the team from the present into the not-too-distant past. The nature of this trip would have to be carefully calibrated. It would have to be pleasant enough so as not to scare Nadia away, yet forceful enough to leave her no opportunity to turn back. Even Gabriel, who had devised the strategy, placed their chances of success at no better than 1 in 3. Elie Lavon was still more pessimistic. But then Lavon, a student of biblical disasters, was a warrior by nature. At that moment, though, the prospect of failure was the farthest thing from Lavon's thoughts. Bundled in several layers of wool, remnants of operations past, he was plodding along the grassy shoulder of the Rue de Valais, a walking stick in one hand, his head seemingly in the clouds. He paused briefly to stare at the passing Maybach limousine. To do otherwise would have been odd, but paid no attention to the little Renault hatchback that followed in the big sedan's wake like a poor relation. Behind the Renault, the road was deserted, which is precisely what Leon was hoping for. He lifted his hand to his mouth and, feigning a cough, informed Gabriel that the target was proceeding as instructed, with no surveillance other than that of the home team. By then, the Maybach had already made the turn onto the Route des Aides, and was sweeping past the old vineyard at flank speed. It ducked through the imposing front gate of the chateau, then headed up the long, straight gravel drive, at the end of which stood Yossi, in a pose of idleness only money could buy. He waited until the car had come to a stop before advancing slowly toward it, but froze when al-Kamal emerged in an aggressive black blur. The Saudi bodyguard stood beside the car for several seconds, his eyes flickering over the facade of the grand manor house, before finally opening the rear passenger door at a strict 45-degree angle. Nadia emerged slowly and in stages. A costly boot upon the gravel, a jeweled hand across the top of the door, a flash of silken hair that seemed to gather the remaining light of the afternoon. For reasons Gabriel did not share with the others, he had decided to mark the occasion with a photograph, which resides in the file rooms of King Saul Boulevard to this day. Snapped by Chiara from a window on the second floor, it shows Nadia taking her first step across the forecourt with Zoe at her side, one hand stretched hesitantly toward Thomas Fowler, the other clutching the bottle of Latour by the neck. Her brow is already slightly furrowed, and in her eyes is the faintest flicker of recognition. It was true that she had once seen this man on the island of St. Bart's, in a charming little patio bar overlooking the salt marshes of Saline. Nadia had been drinking daiquiris that day. The man, burned by the sun, had nursed a beer a few tables away. He had been accompanied by a scantily dressed woman with sandstone-coloured hair and generous hips, the same woman who was now stepping from the front entrance of the house in clothing that matched Nadia's in cost and style. A woman who was now holding onto Nadia's hand, as though she had no intention of ever letting go.
"I'm Jenny Fowler," said Ramona Stan. "I'm so thrilled you're joining us. Please come inside before we all catch our death."
The first leg of Nadia's journey complete, they turned in unison and started toward the entrance of the house. The bodyguard briefly attempted to follow, but Nadia, in her first act of conspiracy, stilled him with a gesture of her hand and a few reassuring words of murmured Arabic. If she thought her hosts would not understand, she was mistaken. The Fowlers were both fluent Arabic speakers, as was the petite woman with dark hair waiting beneath the chandelier in the grand main foyer. Again Nadia's expression was one of distant recollection.
"I'm Emma," said Dina Sarid. I'm an old friend of the Fowlers. It's so nice to meet you."
Nadia grasped the outstretched hand, another stage of the journey complete, and allowed Dina to draw her into the vaulted great room. Standing before a row of French doors, her gaze fixed on the elaborate terraced garden, was a woman with pale blonde hair and skin the colour of alabaster. Hearing the sound of footsteps, the woman turned slowly and stared at Nadia for a long moment with expressionless blue eyes. She didn't bother to offer a false name. It wouldn't have been appropriate.
"Hello, Nadia," Sarah Bancroft said finally. "It's lovely to see you again."
Nadia recoiled slightly, and seemed frightened for the first time.
"My God," she said after a moment of hesitation, "is it really you? I was afraid you were... dead?"
Nadia made no reply. Her eyes moved slowly from face to face before coming to rest on Zoe's.
"Do you know who these people are?"
"Of course."
"Do you work for them?"
"I work for CNBC in New York."
"So why are you here?"
"They need to talk to you. There was no other way."
Nadia appeared to accept the explanation, at least for the moment. Again her gaze moved around the room. This time it settled on Sarah.
"What is this about?"
"It's about you, Nadia."
"What about me?"
"You're trying to change the Islamic world. We want to help."
"Who are you?"
"I'm Sarah Bancroft,
the American girl who sold your father a painting by Van Gogh. After that, he offered me a job as his personal art consultant. I went on your annual winter cruise in the Caribbean. Then I went away."
"Are you a spy?"
Nadia asked. But Sarah made no reply other than to extend her hand. Nadia's journey was nearly complete. She had just one more stop to make. One last person to meet.